Tony, the floor is yours.
Okay. Hi, this is my name is Tony Kofer. I'm from Purdue University. Today I'm going to be discussing the film evaporation MEMS tunable array, or PEMTA for short. We threw the water and microthruster in the title so it would be a little bit more descriptive than it was for an aerospace application. Okay, if we'd like to start, the PowerPoints have no embedded movies per se, but there are some PowerPoint animations, so you may want to go to full screen for that. Okay, the first title page is pretty self-explanatory. I do have the NASA icon on the corner. Signifies that we are funded by the NASA SmallSat program in a partnership with NASA Goddard. So we have been getting our money from them. Moving on to the second, just a simple outline of what I'll be covering today. Simple, the introduction to tell you how this thing works and what it does. A little bit about the microfabrication. The testing and results we've had so far, and what we're currently working on. So move on to slide 3, our introduction. Some more bullet points. The motivation of what we're trying to do here, a thrust requirement for our particular size CubeSat. The options that are currently available, and then going into the actual thermal valving concept. So we'll move on to slide number 4. Okay, the motivation is, as you all know, miniaturized electronics is allowed for smaller and smaller payloads, or smaller space vehicles, to be made a lot more cheaply and launch cheaply. But the problem is that most propulsion systems don't scale down well because of viscous effects and such things. And you end up with a low mass fraction where you have a rather large thruster to move a very small satellite. Also, many of them have high power requirements, which are not going to be available on a CubeSat. So, switch to slide 5. Okay, this is just a simple analysis for a 1U CubeSat. We said it needed a 180-degree slew in 1 minute, which is not unreasonable. And the calculations come out to we need 54 micronewtons of force to be applied. Of course, it won't be all in the same direction. Well, that will be, but you'll also need to slow it down, so double that. Okay, move on to slide 6. Okay, here's power versus thrust for the available options right now. As you see, there are quite a lot of different electric propulsion options, the vacuum arc thruster and a field emission electric propulsion, electrospray, all of those, electrothermal. They usually have very high ISPs, but they are kind of power hogs, so to speak. cold gas, it doesn't really scale down well. It doesn't take as much power and get a lot more thrust out of it, though. About the only thing you see where our PEMTA is on the line, but the only thing that can match that is the solid MEMS digital type thrusters, but they have their own set of problems. So we'll move on to slide 7. Okay, here are some of the available ones. There's a cold gas thruster there. I believe it's by VACO. It takes up about half of the mass budget for a 1U CubeSat, and about a quarter of the volume. So that's really would take up a lot of space needed for your payload hardware. Okay, the electro spray there, I believe, is worked on by people at MIT. Very high ISP, but it also takes a bit more power, and also it's pointing in one direction and takes 2 hours to warm up. The vacuum arc thruster there, it kind of resembles a spark plug. I believe they made those at George Washington University. One of the professors who designed that, Professor Shishirin, is currently working here at Purdue. Very neat, very simple, but it's also kind of heavy. I mean, 40 grams. It doesn't seem like much, but you compare it to the thing we've been working on, can be made about the size of a sugar cube with a gram of propellant in it. The power can be, we have gotten thrust at 10 milliwatts. So, and that scales up about 230 micronewtons per watt is our thrust to power ratio.
Excuse me, this is David Krejcik from MIT. One question, Tony. Can you tell me what you mean by effective ISP? These numbers are significantly smaller.
Effective ISP takes into the mass of the thruster itself.
So that would mean a bigger tank would lead to a higher ISP in that case?
Yes, it would. Okay. Yes, when you have, you know, just a little bit of propellant and a great big thruster, it kills your ISP, your effective ISP.
Okay.
I mean,
okay, but it's basically then not a performance parameter, but just simply how much propellant you carry.
Yeah,
in respect to your APU. Okay.
Yeah, with your, you know, your mass fraction of everything that's involved there. I mean, if you get an ISP of, you know, 10,000 and your mass fraction is, you know, 1 gram for 1,000 to the thruster side, and it's not too great. But,
okay, I was just a little bit confused because it's then not a performance anymore, but it's simply impacted by the system design. So if you carry more propellant, that would magically
increase
ISP.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
But if you have a limited volume, you can't really do that. That's the problem with the 1U CubeSat platform is, you know, it is a standard size and you're stuck with it. So if you can cram it into the 1U, then or else you'll have to go up to the 2U or...
Yeah, I mean, I guess you got the problem for cold gas, but I think like the arc and the electro spray here, they could simply carry more propellant, I guess. Okay, thanks for the clarification.
Oh, no problem. Okay, move on to slide 8. What the FEMTA uses is the small scale effects of surface tension and hydrophobicity to offset the vapor pressure inside of a fluid. We don't really need a valve. We have the propellant is actually exposed to vacuum. Here you see just the temperature curves versus temperature for water and ethylene glycol, which is what we use for our initial proof of concept experiments, but it doesn't make good propellant. The ethylene glycol doesn't. It's just too heavy and too sticky. Move on to slide 9. So what it comes down to is a critical capillary size. If the size is small enough, it can hold the meniscus against background pressure caused by vapor pressure and any internal pressures you might add. Of course, this is very dependent on the contact angle. Now, these have to be, you know, greater than 90, much preferably much greater. But it is there, and the capillary size for water, that's what you see there is with the 180 degree contact angle, is down in the micron size, which makes it a little tricky for manufacturing, but we'll come back to that. Next slide, 10. Okay, this is one of the animated slides. As you can see there, this is our original design was a plug annular nozzle. The water is held in place there by the silicon because it's hydrophobic and sits there even in vacuum. The gap size is about 10 microns. We have a tiny heater built into the wall, and if you press once, okay, the things disappear. Press it again. The heaters heat up, heat the water. Press again. The meniscus moves up to the throat, and finally, vacuum boiling occurs.
Hey, Tony, let me ask you a question about this. This is Lester. I'm trying to understand. You say the liquid is contained by the hydrophobic surfaces. I'm wondering what is preventing that water from just boiling away. That is, you got a 10 micron gap. The pressure above the water, if it weren't anything else, would be near zero. So why didn't the water just sit there boiling?
There's several different effects going on at once. One is you have the surface tension effect, which is like a skin on the surface of the water. That helps hold it back. Also, as the water evaporates, it cools the meniscus, which reduces the vapor pressure.
That's interesting. Well, let's see. Yeah. So, Tony,
I got another question. What about if this is the surface is in the sun? How's it going to deal with that?
It's probably not going to like it a whole lot. You don't want to heat up the water too much. It does have a certain range. Our firing temperature is about 50 degrees C.
Okay. Well, let me ask. I was trying to get a follow-up question, Tony. In the little white area that's above the dark blue, what is the pressure in there? Is it zero? Is it one atmospheric pressure? What's keeping that water from boiling? I'm just wondering.
As I said, the very surface of the meniscus does cool down and possibly even freezes. We don't know. It's pretty small there. Because when the water evaporates, it's taking the energy of vaporization from the fluid.
Right. No, that's true. Okay, but that's interesting that the water, if it's exposed to the vacuum of space, your water doesn't just disappear of its own accord. That's really interesting.
It will evaporate. There is a certain evaporative loss. I'll cover that later.
Oh, okay.
But it's much, much, much lower than the mass flow during firing, like a couple orders of magnitude.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. What about freezing, too? Do you have a way to mitigate that issue?
Well, if it's just freezing on the meniscus, that's not that much of a problem, as long as it doesn't freeze the whole thing. But it hasn't shown it to do that. Usually just, the vapor pressure on the surface drops down because of the cold temperature, and it reaches an equilibrium point.
Okay.
Next slide, 11. Okay, here is the proposed device. We have 12 of these little guys on a CubeSat to give full 3-axis rotational control. I mean, you can just like stick them anywhere. This was intended to be an array. We do have a whole lot of little bitty ones. We haven't made that yet. We made like one big one. There shows the actual or the single nozzle. So I'll discuss later. We abandoned the plug annular design early on. There's also a substrate heater there because when these things are firing, the temperature of the liquid does drop. It can be used to, it can be heated back up using waste heat from like electronics equipment, or you could have a substrate heater there to slowly replace it if you're in a cold area or something, or if it's too cold. Okay, going on to slide 12. Okay, here's a little model CubeSat we made and stuck 12 of them on there. These are actually 6 in a duplex mode. It has a nozzle on each end, and they're angled to provide thrust at right angles to the axis of rotation. But that would be, you know, about the size of them. Those would hold, you know, a couple of grams in each one, so it'd be like 1 gram per nozzle. But you could always have bigger tanks if you wanted to. The thing is, these tanks, they're at very, very low pressure, just a little above vapor pressure, actually. So you're talking about, you know, kilopascals. Okay, we'll get into the microfabrication part, which was, I'd like to say, enjoyable, but I won't, because it was very tedious. Okay, we have done 3 generations of these things. The first one, see on slide 14, as I said, we abandoned the plug annular nozzle because trying to line the thing up, you know, with a perfect gap all the way around would it be a 10 micron gap would have been well beyond what I can do anyway. So instead, we decided to go with just a long slit and bring that down to a 10 micron wide throat. Originally, we put nichrome heaters on the inside of it and a gold conductor on the outside for electrical contacts. Okay, this also helps for 2D modeling. Okay, on slide 15, you'll see SEM pictures of some of the first models we made. We broke them in two to show the nozzle itself. And you can see on the bottom SEM picture the nichrome heaters there. They're about 10 microns wide. Going to slide 16. Another close-up of the heater elements. And on page 17, even more pictures. This was our aspect ratio of 8. The one before was aspect ratio of 2. These things have shown to be pretty sensitive to aspect ratio. If you get them too long, they don't get the thrust if they're too short, or then they're the shorter ones. Or if they're too short, then you get uncontrollable thrust. I'll show you that later on. Okay, moving on to, I don't think I went backwards. Okay, on slide 18, our first generation with the nichrome heaters did not last very long. We are using ultra-pure deionized water for propellant, and it ate up the nichrome like battery acid. You can see pictures of that there. It's just galvanic corrosion. You put any kind of a current through it, and it would just eat it up. So we switched that later on. Our second generation units, we decided to pile on the nichrome to see if that helped it. We made 4 different aspect ratios, a throat. You see there, 2, 4, 6, and 8. The inlets are on the top. The bottom is the exit. We didn't really want a diverging nozzle there. That's why it's kind of flat and moved aside. But we had to remove material from the bottom of the silicon wafer to make the throat as short as we needed. Because at the Reynolds numbers we're using here, diverging nozzles really don't help much or can be a hindrance because of the viscous effects. Okay, moving on to slide 20. Here's our third generation. We decided instead of having the conical looking nozzle, we made just what's supposed to be straight sides. We did this because the first and second generation nozzles were made on 4-inch by 200 micron thick silicon wafers, which had to be handled and just broke all the pieces most of the time. So the third generation, we went to a much thicker 500 micron wafer and just put the nozzle in at the top there, you see, and just removed a lot of material from underneath.
Tony, let me ask, what is the temperature of the water vapor that's coming out? I mean, it's steam. So what kind of temperatures are you talking about?
We're assuming it's 50 degrees. Well,
oh, that's all. Wow. Okay. I was going to say it would seem that the hotter the better. I mean, your ISP is going to increase as the vapor gets hotter. So
yeah. To do that, we could do that, but we would have to make the throat narrower to reach the critical to hold it back to the critical point.
Right, or and also you'd probably have to use more power in your nichrome wire just to heat
you
it up.
You would too. Yes, it would take more wire. There's more, more power.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, this is still all stuff still in development. We're still working on that. Yes, as you see, we did the third generation. I believe slide 21, we show the different generations. As I said, we started in nichrome, and it just dissolved on us. So we switched to vanadium because we had it there, and it's supposed to be resistant to strong sulfuric acid, seawater, but apparently not deionized water, ultra-pure, because it oxidized and went away too. So we finally bit the bullet and went with platinum, which works just great, but it's pretty expensive. It's not something you want to spend a whole lot of time experimenting with. Okay, so now we get to slide 22, the testing phase. we did evaporative loss measurement that we mentioned earlier on the generation one, because that's all they were good for. If you put power on them, the heater burned out and it was gone. And we've got thrust measurements on the gen two, barely, and then the Gen 3, we got some pretty good measurements. We measure mass flow in a kind of a roundabout way. I'll go into that, and I'll show you the ISP calculations we have so far. Okay, slide 23 shows the test vessel we made to hold the Fenta while we did the evaporative test. The nozzle itself is actually pointing down, and the little fitting you see on the top is to relieve atmospheric pressure off of it as it's pumping down. Later on, we switched to just a simple pressure relief valve, and that works sometimes. Okay, slide 24. Shows the vessel mounted in our acrylic vacuum chamber. We have a small one we use for just these purposes. And we put it in there and we pumped it down and measured it before and measured it or weighed it after on an analytic balance to get their mass loss. So slide 25 shows you our losses. We did a number of tests, and they run at about 30 milligrams an hour is what we lose, which don't sound like much, but if you only start with a gram of felon, it'll be gone in a day or so. So that won't stand that away, but we're working on a solution to that problem, which I'll get into in the later current work section.
So just to be sort of a purist here, had you previously pumped down the device without solvent in it or without water in it to make sure there were no manufacturing oils or anything that volatilized off?
Oh, yeah, it was pumped down many times.
And it held weight? It didn't drop in mass?
Not much. I mean, it's mostly the things absorb water. So if it loses water, it's got water. So, yeah, we're talking, a milligram maybe.
Okay.
Over an hour. And here we're just losing 30 in there, so it's a matter of scale.
Yeah, okay. Just keeping you honest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because you got to think of everything, but it seems like I never do. But Yeah, that's about what our mass loss is. It was much smaller than the numerically calculated rate using a DSMC and CFD codes. But as I said, there's a lot of effects that goes on in a small scale like that, like ice formation. It was shown to be sometimes in a triple state, and some of our numerical guys just gave up on it. Moving on to slide 26. Okay, here's a diagram of our thrust stand. It was designed by Dr. Andrew Kitziver at USC at the time. It's constructed by Dr. Herbert, who was here at Purdue. If you punch it in at once, you'll see that we use electrostatic fins to calibrate it with. These have a known force at a known voltage, and so we use that for a calibration run each time before we do thrust tests to show the displacement on our LVDT. Okay, moving on to slide 27. This is just the pump speed curve for our diffusion pump, just to illustrate the flat pumping speed there below 10 to the minus 3 tor. This is how we measured our mass flow. Okay, what we did was we let nitrogen into there, measured with the mass flow meter, and integrated the pressure change over time, and got the mass flow of nitrogen for that. Okay, moving on to slide 28, we did an analysis of the diffusion pump conductance with our large right angle valve and all the associated plumbing going to it to get a measure of conductance through that, so we'd have an analytical solution to verify with our experimental. Okay, and then slide 29 shows our actual experiments where we let in measured gas and then showing the pressure changes that were associated with that. We had 60 data points for that. Moving on to slide 30, shows the experimental versus the analytical, which wasn't that far off. It was fairly linear. There was a little gouge there that was always there, but we just learned to live with that. The problem is that we couldn't really take the thruster out of our big vacuum chamber each time and measure it after each pulse. We needed a way to measure mass flow in real time, and this seemed to work pretty well. We, of course, did the experiments in nitrogen and then converted the data for use with water, going by molecular weight and by the difference in the ion gauge constant to change that out. Slide 31 shows our measurement uncertainty. Not wonderful, but it's there, usually around 10% for our ISD. Our thrust we're fairly confident in, but the mass flow is, like I said, about 10% of it. Moving on to slide 31, here's our thrust test setup. We took the little vessel we made for the first generation, and we turned it sideways and put it in our big vacuum chamber on the thrust stand. We exchanged the fitting with a little pop-off valve. Hello?
Still there.
Okay, I just heard something. I thought somebody had a question.
Yeah, that was a little bit odd, but no, you're still online.
Okay. We used the aspect ratio 8 test, the only ones. This was with the second generation, which had the thick nichrome heaters, which did last for just a tiny while. If you go to slide 33 is shows the expected performance, okay? Okay, that would have been at 1 watt power, or 67 milliwatts power. We didn't get anywhere near that. Moving on to slide 34, we didn't even get a micronewton. It was very disappointing, and you have to pretty much squint to even see it, but there is a little rise there, we think. So that's when we went on to our next, let's see, slide 35 shows even more tests with even more vague thrust, barely measurable. Slide 36 is when we went to the third generation. We made a whole new test vessel out of Teflon to try to remove any kind of metal in there so that to reduce the galvanic corrosion. That's when we used the vanadium heaters first, which did work for a while, but did not. But the resistance would drop steadily and or increase steadily until it finally just burned out. Okay, slide 37 shows our thrust stand with the thruster mounted on it. The camera is actually at an angle the thrust stand isn't. It's fairly flat. Okay, thrust stand calibrated from 8 to 768 micronewtons. On to slide 38. Okay, here's where we got some really good thrust at 65 milliwatts. Unfortunately, it was hard to control. You turn the power on, you see where the power interval is. You turn the power on, you might have to wait a few seconds, and then you get a large burst of thrust. And then it would drop down, as you can see, a few seconds before we cut the power to it. It didn't drop down to zero, it just dropped down to another level. But that was much, much more thrust than what we were expecting. The problem with this is we'd also have little, like, burps when there's no command for it. You just all of a sudden have a blip where it'd pop out. This was for an aspect ratio of 2, okay? What we believe is that it was liquid flow through the nozzle instead of gas. It was getting into the larger chamber on the outside and then vaporizing, which gave us the high thrust. So that's why we get just burps. It would spit out little water drops, too, on occasion. So we thought, this probably would not work either because there's just too much uncertainty to it. Here's the ISP's. Hello?
Sorry, one question. Since you always have some evaporation of water going on, how do you calibrate the thrust then to zero?
To zero?
I mean, you're zero. When you mount the thrust
you mean,
on there.
Is there any background thrust going on?
Do you just take that out of the picture, or is it just
too small? Pretty much. We can go by the base pressure, how much liquid is actually getting evaporated. We look
at the background pressure from the chamber.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah. When it's above optimal, then you know that there's water vapor being added. And between that and the numerical studies, they assume we'd have about a micronewton of thrust all the time.
Okay, thanks.
Just from the evaporation. But there we had, 600 micronewtons.
Okay, thanks.
And on slide 39, you can see the ISP summary of all those tests. We did quite a number of them. And they run around 50 to 60 seconds most of the time. until you get to the higher power, and then for some reason it dropped. We haven't figured that out. But on slide 40, you'll see a temperature measurement we made while it was thrusting. Actually, it's from that very same experiment. You see the water temperature did drop while it was thrusting. On slide 41, I did an entropy generation calculation to make sure that wasn't nothing really screwy. Okay, you should have positive generation if it was feasible. And it turns out it is. The thing is, it's just an endothermic process, what with the vaporization going on and expansion into vacuum. So it's not that surprising then. I mean, you put energy into a refrigerator to make it cold too. Okay, going on to 42. Okay, here's our generation 3 with aspect ratio of 4, thrust versus power. We shot it with 10 pulses at 75 milliwatts each and got fairly reproducible thrust out of it each time. So, on to 43. Here shows the same thing and also shows the pressure monitor showing the mass flow into the chamber. So there wasn't just some sort of induction or any of that going on. On to 44.
Here's I've got a, I, yeah. Tom, this is Harley. Got a question about the series of slides, 42, 43, 44. Did in any of your tests you just ran and ran and ran it for hours or until you ran out of fuel?
Yeah.
I mean, so the reproducibility, which is pretty impressive for a technology that you're sort of exploring the low TRL on this. It's pretty impressive reproducibility. So there were some where you ran for hours.
Yeah, these tests were run, over many hours.
I was going to say, just not, what is this, 20 minutes here? There was some that you ran for 10 times that, say.
Yeah, I mean, these were run, over many hours, actually.
Oh, fine. Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah, actually, it was overnight. While you get data, getting good data, you keep at it.
Yeah, so that's why you have good Purdue undergrads to sit there and watch it all night.
Well, I was a grad student at the time, but...
Okay, thank
that's
you.
That's hard on an old man. Yeah. But anyway, on the next slide, let's see. There's a 150 milliwatt thrust test. Okay, we ran several tests there, 25 milliwatts, 50, 75, all those all night. And they pretty much laid out in a line there, about 230 micronewtons per watt. Our firing time seemed to be about 200 milliseconds from the time that power is applied till it starts and till after it's cut, till it drops off. Okay, here's the mass flow on slide 46 versus the power. That's in micrograms per second. So it was fairly linear. On 47, we're showing the ISP, which was actually a bit higher than what we were expecting. But then again, our 50-degree assumption may not be valid. That was what we were shooting at. The vapor may be hotter than that. You know, if it's 60 or 70 degrees, that could change that. Also, the nozzle does act like a diverging nozzle, converging-diverging nozzle, sort of. So that may be why it's higher than just a sonic nozzle. But it did seem to plateau at the higher applied power. Okay, on to slide 48. Okay, just the thrust-to-power ratio. The little squares are the ones and the aspect ratio of 2 that we had such high thrust, but it was uncontrollable, and it kind of bounced around. If we could control it, we were getting like 5 millinewtons a watt, but also the ISP wasn't that great. It was down in the 40-50 range, second range. Okay, on to slide 49. Coefficient of performance, which is an air conditioning term to tell about, you know, how much heat out you get from heat in or heat input. As you see, the ones where we got the good thrust test weren't cooling at all. In fact, they were heating the bulk fluid a little bit. The other ones were cooling great, but we didn't get the desired thrust or the desired ISP either, or the controllable thrust. So this is one of our things we're looking at now, is trying to find the sweet spot in aspect ratio, whether it's 4, 3.5, or 3.75. We're working on that. Okay, slide 50. It shows our flow characteristics. As I said, we're assuming 50 degrees C and sonic flow at the nozzle exit. So all the rest of that, our Reynolds number is like 13, which is very sticky flow. Knudsen number is 0.1, which puts it in a transitional regime. Okay, slide 51. Okay, to what we're working on right now, our current work, we're trying to put shutters on it to eliminate the evaporative loss when it's not being used. We're integrating RTDs into the throat so that we can get accurate temperature measurements of what's going on inside of there. We've also building arrays just so you can add more power on the same chip. Need more thrust, you can just add more nozzles. Also, if we have to, we can put different nozzles of different aspect ratios to get different performance effects, whether you want tightly controlled thrust or just a big whopping bunch of thrust or cooling or whatever. And finally, working on packaging for what would hope to be a flight test. Slide 52 shows our electrostatic actuated shutters. This was just an idea. We've abandoned this one more or less. We might come back to it. What we worry about is stiction of the shutter on the bare silicon. Once silicon touches silicon, a lot of times it'll stick together, and we don't really want that too much for that. And the electrostatic force is pretty weak. It's too weak to break it. Slide 53. The bimorph actuated shutters is what we're actually working on. Actually, the team there at Goddard are working on it. Carl Kotecki drew this picture. He works there. They're using aluminum and tungsten, and say they can get an actuating shutter work at like 30 milliwatts power. So that would stop any or most of the evaporative losses. Slide 54, the nozzle arrays. Once we get one to where we want it, then we can make a bunch of them on there. I've already made an array of 3, which are just 3 of the same thing we have now, but we haven't tested them yet. On slide 55, the integrated RTDs. All we're going to do is slice off a piece of the heater using a focused ion beam and use that as a resistance temperature detector. And finally, slide 56. This is what the whole thing is supposed to look like. We're going to have an elastic bladder to provide a few hundred pascals of background pressure to feed the water into the nozzle, a miniature pressure relief valve, and a casing of some sort. But we're hoping to keep this, you know, under 2 cubic centimeters size. finally, slide 57, here are my acknowledgments for everyone who's helped out on this. And that is all I have for you guys. Any more questions?
Yeah, great, Tony. That's excellent. Thank you so much. That was actually said well-timed and done at about the right level for, I think, a lot of the folks being very tutorial, very tutorial-oriented, which is a kind of presentation that we like. So just as Tony was asking folks, are there other questions for him? Do folks out there have questions?
Yeah, hi. Question, again, on the fluid. To address kind of like the freezing and the impedance boil off from heat, have you looked at something like ammonia or some other fluids which have a wider temperature band and might not be a contaminant on any optics?
The problem with ammonia is it has to be pressurized, and the pressure has to be so great that your throat size would probably be down in a nanometer scale. Also, you have to find a surface that is hydrophobic against. I'm not sure how ammonia works that way. What we're working with now is water and silicon, because water has very high surface tension, which you also need. So you need high surface tension, a hydrophobic surface, and a low vapor pressure.
Okay, other questions, folks, for Tony? Got a bit of time left. We've got about 10 minutes left, so folks, this is a great opportunity to ask some questions. And I want to encourage, once again, our Goddard interns, if you're online, to ask away. Other questions? Okay, hearing none, Tony. Thank you again. Thank you for bringing it
up. Oh, I forgot to mention that all those power tests were done from between 2 and 5 volts. So that's the input voltage, in case anybody's interested.
Okay, thanks again. So, folks, thank you all for joining us. Tony, thanks for an excellent presentation. Very good questions. And talk to you all next week.